guess we'll just keep the chairs where they are. And the idea here is to provide you with an opportunity to ask questions about any of the presentations that you heard today, including the plenary presentations, okay? And so feel free to direct your questions to one person in particular if you want more than one person to respond. And we'll just keep it going as long as there's an interest.
Identify as homosexual, everything ranging from second and fourth digit ratios to hair swirls. So it's a really interesting field. Some of it I'm not quite sure what to make of it. I think some of the research suggests that, for example, in 90% of heterosexual men, their hair swirls, which is this little spot right back here, swirl clockwise, whereas in homosexual men, more than 20% swirl counterclockwise. And that this 2-4 digit ratio, the difference between the second and fourth finger, is thought to be an indicator of intrauterine testosterone levels. Now, I think trying to look at your fingers and tell if you're gay or not, I think seems to be a little strange, or looking at your swirl in the mirror as well. But there's an awful, there's research out there, I think in many ways, is people just trying to get a better handle on, are there good correlates for sexual orientation? I think that sexual orientation is actually a lot more complex than just the hormones that are present during development or just what goes on, when you grow up. Many of the researchers, I think Dr. Loy mentioned this earlier, and then maybe I'll pass it off to you, have mentioned that for men, the issue of sexual orientation seems to be much more, the term that they use is essentialist. That is, men on average are much more likely to self-identify either as gay or straight, homosexual or heterosexual. And that's just part of who they are, and it's very resistant to change. Whereas, on average, women are much more likely to have their sexual orientation more constructed. That is, it's much more flexible. And the language that's used is called sexual fluidity, that they can, their orientation sort of can be changed or can change. I guess can change is the language that Dr. Loy used. So maybe I'll pass that over to you.
Well, what he said, there's a lot of research that's exploring the idea that if you're a man who's attracted to other men, then in that sense you must be sort of feminine. And if you're a woman who's attracted to other women, then you must in some way be sort of masculine. And so then the hunt is on for other indicators that maybe if you, are a man who's attracted to other men and you're feminine in that way, are you sort of feminine or somewhat feminine in other ways? And there is a big literature on that, which really doesn't produce compelling, overwhelming results. There's a lot of diversity. You can't know, for example, you can't say do a cognitive test, a series of cognitive tests of a man and notice that he tends to fall in the distribution that's most common for women and then be able to accurately predict whether or not he's got same-sex desires. The correlations are weak, but they are present and they are statistically significant. So it's a complex area, and I'm really don't want to toot my own horn, but I did write a whole paper on this question because it is really complicated, and so I would suggest maybe you look at that and some of the literature I cite there if you want to know about that in more detail.
Can I give a stab at that? If I understood your question correctly, then I might have something relevant to say about it. I've been interested in the issue of identity and gender and desire ever since medical school. And that's partly because when I was a student at Stanford Medical School, the very first gender reassignment surgeries were being done. And in the West Coast, those were being done by Donald Laub, who was head of plastic and reconstructive surgery at Stanford. Don Laub, I took the clerkship and subsequently became quite good friends with Donald Laub, and talked with him many times and had him to my classes year after year after year. So I've followed this to some extent. And then that was complemented in turn by my serving together with Paul McHugh on the President's Council on Bioethics. And Paul McHugh was head of psychiatry at Johns Hopkins, and he was interested in this subject and, in fact, wrote a book which more or less maintained that this idea of a confused gender identity was a form of psychological displacement and not what he considered a subject worthy of medical intervention. But let me say this much about it, just briefly. What I understood from your question was, is there a different source to the notion of gender identity versus sexual desire? And on that, I have an interesting thing to report, and this is purely anecdotal in the sense that it's a study of one. But there is a neuroscientist at Stanford who is public on this, or otherwise wouldn't speak of it. But this is a neurobiologist who is a world authority on one aspect of neurobiology, glial cells, and a very thoughtful individual whose mother used a medical therapy of chemical nature during pregnancy when she was pregnant with a female fetus who she named Barbara when she was born. And Barbara lived as an uncomfortable female until, I don't know, maybe 15 years ago, went through Harvard and came to Stanford as a professor and then decided that she was more truly identifiable as Ben. But the interesting thing about this case is that Ben reports that he always had felt male in his gender identity, but had always been attracted to males in terms of sexual desire. So Ben is now transgendered, at least partly transgendered anatomically. It takes hormones, but says that he experiences sexual attraction to males. So he's a homosexual practicing, or at least inclined, transgendered male. And the interesting thing is when he talks to my neuroscience class, he says he believes that sexual identity is a different phase of experience, so to speak, or of establishment in embryogenesis, so that he believes that the hormones that his mother took affected his gender identity, but not his natural gender attraction. Which you're following all that. And just to close with one other thing. When I first got interested in this subject, I didn't know what to make of it. I had just become a Christian in earnest and having been raised sort of vaguely. And I wanted to serve God in a compassionate way. I thought it was a very interesting subject from a theoretical neuroscience perspective. And despite the fact I spoke on stem cells this morning, my real interest is in the ethical implications and human implications of advancing neuroscience. So that's really what I do. I went and interviewed two patients who were in for gender reassignment. And this was like 1972 or something like that. And I have never spent I've never spent a day talking to two patients where I felt their pain so deeply. I said this morning that infertile patients suffer a great deal. Well, this is sort of the complementary dimension of that, gender identity and sexuality, very sensitive subject. These people reported very, very sad lives and very deep struggles in their lives. I frankly didn't know what to make of it, even after spending all day talking with them. But I realized it was a subject for which we need to be deeply compassionate. Now, Donald Laub, interestingly, is a practicing Catholic. And he, before he did these surgeries, went to see his bishop. I think his name was Dumaine, Bishop Dumaine. He was actually head of the the National Conference of Catholic Bishops Science Committee, and Dumaine listened to him and, of course, had limited knowledge, but at least went so far as to say he thought that Donald Laub had presented a case that there was some reason to investigate this as a pathology or as an all difference, whatever way you want to frame it, but that it might be a subject of surgical intervention, and on that basis, this practicing Catholic, Don Laub, began initiating the surgical interventions. Paul McHugh, also is a practicing Catholic. He believes that these surgeries are unjustified. He believes that what's going on in transgendered individuals, gender identity confused individuals or ambiguous approaches, he believes there is a displacement of other psychological pain with an excuse being made that it's because they're in the wrong body. He also believes there's an element of homosexuality involved in the desire to kind of engage. I'm not quite sure how he frames this up. There are many strange things with regard to sexual identity, not the least of which, I might just throw out, is a condition in which, for some reason or other, individuals feel that if only they could have a limb amputated, they would be sexually whole. So this is an extremely difficult subject, certainly one for open-minded exploration, but we shouldn't be foolish about it either. Just because somebody says something doesn't make it real. I think in any case, it's a subject for great sensitivity and compassion.
I don't really want to answer a question, but I really want to very much follow up on that and really ask particularly these two, maybe Bill as well. I mean, what came out to me through both your presentations was, you know, so much you're often dealing with a continuum. There are various intermediate states which are, whether you use that term or not, I don't know, but which are not very clearly, you know, one side or the other. And almost there's a lot of fluidity. And yet, when so often you look at the church, however, you know, talking that in very general terms now, or churches, they tend to look upon so many of these things in black and white terms, because that's what they see coming through from scripture, church tradition, etc. And the sort of, pain and struggle that Bill has just mentioned and, empathizing doesn't tend to come through. And I just wonder particularly the two of you, what your thoughts are on this in terms of where you are coming from the science side of it. And, I mean, in a sense, what do you really need to say to some of these church leaders? And also, of course, in terms then of how they interpret scripture.
Oh, it's such a difficult thing. I've just been blessed with a sabbatical this past year, and one of the things I spent a lot of time reading about, talking to people about, pondering, was the question of why is sex such a big deal? Is it universally such a big deal? And by such a big deal, I mean, you know, why does it seem to matter so much that, you know, we get it right? And why do we need to hedge it about with rules and restrictions and taboos and stuff? And I'm not doing a Margaret Mead, let's all just go out and be naked and have sex with everybody all the time, like the bonobos or something like that. Not suggesting that, you know, we shouldn't think normatively and thoughtfully about sexuality. But, when I look at the fear and the polarization that happens, like you talked about the black and whiteness of it, you're either here or you're there. I teach and work in a Christian liberal arts university, and boy, oh boy, the senior administration gets awfully nervous when I go around giving talks about human sexuality. Not because they want to shut down what I'm doing, they're very supportive and affirming, but because they know that the Christian public that supports our institution, there's some really strong feelings about this stuff out there. And if anybody, you know, if we're thought to say anything or do anything that violates that, it's like this wall goes up or this door slams shut, and it's like we can't talk about it. We there's a wonderful Joe Wise song that talks about, you know, we stand and watch each other now from separate shores. And so I'm mystified as to why this is so important. And it seems that there are dynamics going on that I think we need to draw on the humanities, theology and philosophy, particularly to help us here. I'm not sure science helps us very much. I do find if I can talk to people about, if I can walk with them and they will take the time to learn about, like even just the process of sexual differentiation and how complicated it is. Like Dr. Struthers here, he gave you that diagram, and that was a simplified diagram. And then you think about, you know, the ways in which sexual differentiation, the many paths in which it can take and the variety. And if you can get people even to get their heads around the concept of somebody being ambiguous in some way with regard to just biological sex, then you can start having conversations about nice little categories and black and whiteness and stuff. But that takes time. And it's really hard to get people to even be willing to sit down long enough because they get really squirmy about it. And I don't know, I think, you know, I've been reading a lot about René Girard and scapegoat theory, about terror management theory, and that something about sexuality and marginal groups and our fear of animality and our mortality. I think there may be some really deep dynamics that the anthropologists and the theologians and the philosophers can help us with here. But I don't have any easy answers. I'm sorry.
That was great. That's a good point. I would probably add to that this notion of this spectrum, and personally, I before I go into the scientific aspect of it, I'll come to the faith side of it, where yes, God is love, and oftentimes people will criticize those who are liberal or who are progressive that they only emphasize the love and they don't emphasize the other side, which is, you know, God is just. And so you have those on the other side who want to focus overly on justice and to the exclusion of those who are in the middle. And as a person of faith, I keep coming back to Jesus, who is the fulfillment of the law. And Jesus didn't always come and always have the same message for everyone. He knew the people that he was speaking to. And for the Pharisees, he had some pretty harsh words. And to the prostitutes, they were much more words of compassion. So I think that when we look at that, oftentimes we want to be like Jesus, and we are to be like Jesus. But I think I want to say that humanity as a whole, that Christians as a whole, I need to take advantage of the fact that my wife can see things in a way that I can't. And sometimes her perspective is what's needed in that situation, and I need to defer to that, and I need to honor her in that way. And other times there are ways that I see what's needed in a situation that's very different from what she sees. And what is needed is what I have to speak into that situation. So I think when we honor each other and we give other people permission to step into those moments, just as Jesus stepped into moments. And sometimes, he goes in and he goes into the temple and he turns over tables. And as a guy, say, yeah, there you go. And then there's other times there's a prostitute wiping his feet with her tears. And I say, well, I don't get that. But I think that when you look at the way that we are neurologically, there are some things that we get and there are some things that we don't get. And just because we don't get them doesn't mean that it's not good. But to go to either extreme is important. And getting back to this issue of homosexuality, I think you see that you've got the two extremes. You've got those who say homosexuality is a sin, it's wrong, should never be done, and they forget that there are real people involved here. And then there are others who say, you know, if you're gay, that's okay. We're going to marry you. We're going to acknowledge that it's the same thing as male and female marriage. And they forget about God's scripture, about his commands. And I think when we can find that place where we can be more like Jesus and give other people to be Jesus in situations, that's what we should be striving to. So that's as a person of faith. As a scientist, I walk into that and I say, oh, I think the science is on our side. The truth is on our side. When you look at the way that male and female brains can complement each other and egalitarian each other, I know that sometimes terms in Christian circles, we kind of get a little weird about that. I think that's the beautiful thing about a father and a mother and a family and a community of faith, that really we don't have to be Jesus for everyone. And I think neurologically that's what you're going to find as well. personality affects gender differences? Well, maybe a different way of thinking about it is that gender is one of the voices in the choir, and personality can be another voice in the choir, and family systems can be another voice in the choir. And at the end of the day, each person's life is going to have all of these multi-causal factors speaking into it, and also multi-maintenance factors as well. That it's not just always about, you just find the one thing that caused it, and your aces, you can have it figured out. Or you find the one wrong way of thinking about something and then the problem goes away. Oftentimes, whether they be issues related to sexuality or interpersonal relationships, that there are many things that feed into getting you to that place, and there are many things that are keeping you in that place as well. And part of the task of the therapist is to help people understand why they came into that and help them to use as many tools as they can to get out of those places and to move. So I wouldn't want to say that it's just personality or just gender, but to try to focus on what are the voices that are speaking into this? How did we get to this place? And how do we adopt a way that uses all of the things that we have at our disposal, whether it be medication or therapy, or as Dr. Jones mentioned earlier, the cingulotomy stuff, I love that with OCD. What are the best ways that we can help people move out and to become more like Christ?
That's a really good comment and a really fair one. Behavior therapies have been the most popular for sex offenders. And when we talk about sex offenders, we're talking about pedophiles, we're talking about rapists, we're talking about people who use sex, in ways that hurt, betray trust and destroy other people in really deep ways. Do they work? I'm not really up to date on the latest statistics on therapy for sex offenders. When I was at Queen's, which is in Kingston, Ontario, which is lots of prisons, including these high security places where sex offenders are housed. And so there are professors there that spent a lot of their career working on it. It's really tough to rehabilitate a sex offender. It's really tough. None of the therapies work very well. When you're dealing with an individual who, if you're going to let him out loose, and it's usually him, but not necessarily, into society, recidivism is huge. Like it's highly likely. So people struggle with what can we do? What can we do? Actual and chemical castration have been perhaps the most effective treatments. And what they do is they just simply take away sexual interest altogether and the ability to engage in sexual behavior. Doesn't really change anything deeply and psychologically about the individual. But do the behavior therapies work? Well, kind of, sort of, a little bit, but what do they work on? You know, it seems from all the reviews that no matter what you use them for, what they do is they punish you for sexual desire. And so you end up just simply being afraid of sex, being unwilling. And that's not really a desirable outcome. But if you're talking about a sex offender, you know, sometimes maybe you're just weighing, you know, what's the least awful outcome? You know, get this person really uninterested in sex so at least they won't hurt more people. Some of these sex offenders actually want that. They don't want to keep doing it, but these desires are really compulsive for them. And there may be therapists in the room that have worked with sex offenders that can comment on this better than I can. But you're absolutely right. I mean, if the therapy doesn't work for sexual orientation, we have to ask the question, does it work for anything? And some of them do for some things. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Who's the provost at Wheaton College, just published a book within the past year or so, I would say, called Ex-Gays, I think, where he was part of a study where they looked at people who had gone through this kind of therapy as well. And without getting the details of it right, I want to defer to Stan in the book on that. I think, you know, what he's showing is that sometimes it works and maybe it's not as effective as we might have hoped it would have been. And in some people it does and some people it doesn't. And maybe there are some negative. So it's kind of a, I'd say from my perspective, it's very gray. But I think what you find, though, is with the level of scholarship that Stan has put in the amount of time that he's put into that, as well as one of Wheaton's more famous alumni, Mark Yarhouse, as well, who's out at Regent out in Virginia, who works and does an awful lot of research in the area of homosexuality, that what you're finding is that the voice of identity is really coming to the fore. And even within the last 6 to 9 months, the APA and the homosexual lobby within the APA, the gay, lesbian, transgender, bisexual community, are much more open to hearing arguments about identity that begin with religion and not sexual identity. And this language that they're using now, and you may have seen more of this. This was, I think, on somebody brought to my attention, was on Fox News, that, you know, many evangelicals are becoming a little more less dogmatic in the public conversation about homosexuality. But they're not trying not to cede their theological ground. And the language that's being used now is the notion of congruence, that what you want is you want to get a rooted identity that has this notion of congruence where things fit together. So if I come in as having my identity first rooted in my theology and secondly in my identity, and I say, okay, I'm a Christian, but I'm gay, and I would like to try to change my orientation, then as long as it's not causing harm to me to try to do that, that's okay. But if I'm not able to, well, that's kind of okay, too. I think that there is place for celibate heterosexuals, celibate homosexuals within the church. And I would say the church needs those individuals as part of its testimony. And too often, I think people have said, you know, there's no place for homosexuals in the church at all. You've got to be straight or not. And I think that is one of the reasons why you have the homosexual being a community, is because these people have not found a home in the church. Now, to get to, I think, your second question was the issue of people sort of kind of how a person could become homosexual by things that were done to them. I think the... most of the... I'll refer to what I mentioned earlier. Most of the studies that have looked at self-report from homosexual men. The majority of these homosexual men, sort of even early in childhood, they report knowing that they were different. So they seem to be much more essentialist in their orientation. Whereas with women, you see much less of that. Sometimes they're referred to as political lesbians. As they get older, they sort of intentionally adopt this as their lifestyle, and they take everything else with it. Now, the research has been pretty clear that it's not as though there's any direct link between cross males and females of abuse, that, you know, someone is molested by a homosexual, therefore they become homosexual. That empirical data really isn't there. But you do see, however, that women are much more likely to engage in bisexual experimentation. And you do see, and some of the research that I'm doing now, looking at the influence of pornography on sexual attitudes, for women who are over the age of 35 or 40, they don't like looking at pornography because they grew up in a different time, and a time when culture said women don't look at these things. Well, we've got girls who are 13, 14 years old who have seen Britney Spears kissing Madonna, Miley Cyrus pole dancing, and you name it on MTV, and they're and Katy Perry singing "I Kissed a Girl and I Liked It," whereas you don't see any of the rappers singing "I Kissed the Guy and I Liked It." So for boys, it's much more essentialist, and girls, it's much more constructed. So if there is anyone who's going to be more vulnerable to that kind of grooming, I would say it would be, on average, young ladies as opposed to boys.
Well, let me just make a little comment on that. This may be a little controversial to say, but I think maybe you could be drawing a slightly wrong conclusion from that, this essentialist stuff. I think there's a sense in which the female body is a symbol of sexuality, and that it's not a difference of inclination of homosexuality. It's that the female body is, for both males and females, a symbol of sexuality in a way that the male body isn't. And I think, yeah, there are differences in a lot of differences, but I think that there's something to that. A little side interesting thing to reflect on, when Simon LeVay came out, I think it was about 15 or 18 years ago now, with a finding that the third interstitial nucleus of the anterior hypothalamus in homosexuals was in an intermediate size between what's normative for males and females. It's very interesting. In the United States, this was greeted with the evidence that this is just part of the rainbow spectrum of human variation. And in fact, Simon LeVay came to Stanford and taught a course in the program in human biology where I was teaching at the time. And his letterhead showed a rainbow spectrum on the top. Okay, interestingly, Simon LeVay told me that in the United States, this was greeted like, see, we're just all part of the happy family of variation. Diversity is so celebrated. In Europe, it was quite the opposite. His findings were received with real concern that they would now be identifiably pathological. And so, you see, so much goes into the interpretation of this. And so much goes into the finding in the two questions. One of the first questions said established identity. So it was an inevitable dimension of the human person, whereas Jay's comment implied that there was something happening in developmental process that solidified or maybe even altered what would have otherwise happened in different circumstances. I think we have to be very, very careful before we impose conclusions on this mysterious and very, very little understood dimension of human life. And I want to add one other thing, and I don't mean this to be uncompassionate, but in fact, I'll turn it the other way around. I think it's time in our civilization we all started looking at sexuality with a slightly more... let me put it this way. You need to challenge the California model of sex. I was there in the 60s, and it was go with the flow, do your thing, be natural. And there was some good in getting out of our highly rigid social structures and realizing the naturalness of our being again. But I've learned over the years of my own life and observation of others that sex... One of the reasons it these are such contested and difficult issues, as you were referencing, how cruel our black and white statements on sex can be, is it, we're not talking about here, you know, food preference or something. We're talking about something of really, really big deal significance in human civilization. I'm a physician. I've seen sexually transmitted diseases. And we're lucky we're living in an age when syphilis, for the moment, is curable. There's a new strain of multi-drug-resistant gonorrhea emerging in Japan. But most of human history, sex was dangerous, just downright dangerous, not because, and I'm talking about all kinds of sex, but including heterosexuality, sexually transmitted disease has been historically a horror. And unwanted pregnancy is a horror. This is not some place where there won't be natural atmospherics. This is a place where very crucial matters are at stake. And I feel like, without losing a sense of compassion, it's time we started talking seriously about the deep sense of responsibility, deep sense of need for continence of being. You just can't do what you want to do in life in this realm without raising some ethical issues concerning other people. Here I think maybe what's in order is that we all started taking a little more seriously our need to be self-disciplined in our sexuality and maybe a little more severe on ourselves and less on others. Well, I don't know if I've communicated what I meant to say, but I think our society doesn't just need to mush into more kind of liberal generosities on this. We might start to think about some of the implications of it and some of the need for placing sex in a really serious context.
I think that if I could maybe follow up on that, I think that's an excellent point. I think that too often we have this sort of nostalgia where we maybe look back on the 50s as if that was we had it right then in the 50s and everything was peachy keen. And really that's not the case. That traditional world that we grew up in, or that maybe I didn't, I'm only 41, so I didn't grow up in the 50s. But, that traditional view really did not honor women the way that it should have. And the age that we live in now, where the individual is sort of elevated and sex is really all about me and what I can get and how I can avoid the consequences of it, that's not the way it should be either. We need to have the serious discussion about what are we going to move into? How do we honor the sort of the black and white thinking of there are real significant consequences here. There are things that you should do and things that you should avoid doing. But also going on that other side of the spectrum, making sure that we do have compassion and we do recognize that this is a really hard thing. And these impulses, what do you do with the pedophile? I mean, the church does not have a good answer for that. What do you do with the homosexual who does not want to marry someone that they're not attracted to? And that's a conversation that we really haven't had, that we do need to be thinking about what are going to be those principles that ground us as we move forward.
Thank you.
I think the first thing that I would say, I mean, in terms of what you quoted from what I'd said, is that I think we have to be aware of the technological imperative. I mean, while on the one hand, so many areas within technology, so many techniques can be extremely useful and can be used very much for good. And we've got numerous examples of that. But I think we've got to beware of technology, the technological imperative, taking over our world. I mean, taking it over, obviously, because that's what we want. And to think then that, therefore, simply utilizing one form of technology or another is going to solve all our problems, including solving all our suffering, all our pain, all our grief, or whatever else it might be. And I think here you really do have a major worldview battle going on, that those who really can quite easily see that simply the flowering of various technology is going to solve all our problems, completely change us. And that's when you get into some of these speculative realms that obviously came up after my talk. So that's what I really have in mind, that what people call the technological imperative, we've got to be very careful that in the end, it too has limits. And also the way in which technology is used by human beings. It might be used by good people like us, they'll be not always good, and it can be used by people who are very different as well. So it's going to be used by all sorts of people in all sorts of ways, some of which we may find are very beneficial for humanity, and others which may well be quite the opposite. So I think that was just the thrust of what I was saying there. And I won't go on to the second part.
Can you clarify the piece that you were asking about something that Dr. Struthers said you thought contradicted something I said? I just couldn't quite put that together. I'll give it a shot, and then Dr. Struthers will try to clarify. Absolutely, there's plasticity in our thinking, in our neural circuitry. I mean, we're embodied beings, and every time you learn something, every time you experience the fact that you're here and that you will remember it later, means something has changed within you. And so, of course, you know, that wonderful passage by Paul about, you know, whatsoever is lovely and true and, you know, think upon these things. You know, that's a wonderful thing for us to dwell upon. And it will change how we think. It will change our neural circuitry. But not everything can be changed all the time or at every stage of development or easily. There are things that are organized during prenatal development that you really can't do anything about. There are things that can still be pruned and tweaked after birth. You could kind of think about human development as a process whereby, say, for the first 15 or 20 years or so, the world is shaping you, and after that, you're shaping the world, including the next generation. It's not quite that simple. Because you're always being shaped by your experience, and your experience includes what you think about. So I absolutely, you know, and I think that one of the things you think about is when Dr. Jones is talking about these worldview struggles. We live in a time and a culture where we're being told, very loudly and clearly that technology will be the solution to our problems. I'm a real science fiction fantasy fan. I love Star Trek, but boy, I don't believe in the worldview of Gene Roddenberry and his, humanistic, technology will solve everything because we're basically all really good people and we're all going to just figure it out. But that is the message that is shaping our culture. And it's not just technology. It's technology that reflects the idea that we're just all mechanisms. And that, we're all the same in the end. And that whatever a solution that applies to Dr. Jones will apply to me, will apply to Dr. Gruhl and Struthers and so on. And to all of you, and to people in sub-Saharan Africa and people in China and so on. The one size will fit all, and it's all part of this package that we've got. That's very reductive. It's very mechanical, and it. I think it's profoundly dangerous, and I would commend to you reading people like Wendell Berry, who speaks eloquently and evocatively about the problems of this and the ways in which we can think about this differently, and he's a deeply Christian man. I would recommend again the book that I recommended at the end of my presentation by Margaret Farley called Just Love, which is she provides a framework for Christian sexual ethics, which I think will help us get past the black and white and will help us to think deeply. And the other thing I just want to say is so, so important, and this has happened to me, it's happened to countless people I've talked to, is that try not to talk about these things solely in the abstract. Try not to let it be an issue-based thing where you're going to talk about an issue, whether in your church community or your family or your home. If you want to talk about, say, sexuality and homosexuality, talk to people who struggle with same-sex attraction. Talk to them. Get to know them. Get to know their faces. I don't know a single person who hasn't been utterly and deeply moved and transformed by simply being in relationship with others who are different from them, who don't fit their tidy categories. And I would just encourage every single one of us to try to do that, because in the end, it comes down to relationships. It comes down to loving one another. And I think Dr. Jones's point is just really important, that, you know, we need to not just blindly use technology, but to think about why we're doing it, who we are, who the other is, and not just other human beings, but the whole of creation.
Yeah, and I would also add to that, you know, I think that maybe from those of us who find ourselves in the church where we hear nothing but the black and white, we need to be a little more open to, you know, having the conversations with the real people. But I would also say that outside of the walls of the church, the narrative of the people who are struggling with these things seems to not want to listen to the people who want to say there's black and white as well. And so I think, you know, that the danger in only allowing the narrative to be the thing that drives the entire conversation is that you will lose some of the part of that larger choir as well. I think that we're, I'll use a musical analogy, where the church has nothing but men singing bass and a whole choir of men singing bass. Outside the church, you got a whole bunch of soprano ones, and you don't want just soprano ones and bass, you know, twos singing at each other. It's going to sound horrible. What you want is a full choir. You want people who are able to kind of go from one end to really appreciate the human dynamic of it, but also people who are also standing firm on the mandates of Scripture, but people who are able to move in between as well. So I would want to add that. I think that that's all important. Finally, I think to kind of get to the specific question that you asked, there's the fact that we can remember what this conversation was when we leave here is evidence that, you know, we can change our brains. But I do think, or that our brains sort of change themselves. But I think that when you start looking at the way the brain is organized, there are varying levels of plasticity. And plasticity is greatest up in the cortex. And it's, you don't want it to be plastic down in the medulla. I don't want to think, boy, it would be nice to stop breathing and think myself into stop breathing. I mean, that's the medulla is going to say, no, we're not going to let that happen, because it locks itself in before that baby's even born, because we want this to not be plastic. We want it to be reliable. And now that isn't to say that I can't calm myself down and think lovely thoughts and kind of get to a place where my heart rate is slowed, or I can, you know, think about bad things and have my heart rate elevated as well. But the level of plasticity will change. And when you look at sexuality is not up at the top, and it's not entirely all down in the bottom. It's right in the middle, which is why it's so very tricky. And there is flexibility, but there's also a range of flexibility there. I'm not sure I want to presume to know God's design pre-fall, but so I'm going to defer that to anyone else here. what's going on.
That's a very profound question, and I'll make one partial comment on it. The first commandment given in the Bible is go forth and multiply. The priest was telling me, he was sitting on the airplane with somebody who was telling him how unhappy he was in his marriage, and he, finally, after listening to this for about an hour, he said, do you have children? He said, no, we don't want children. And he said, well, did it occur to you that maybe you're unhappy because you're thwarting the natural connection of sexuality and procreation? You know, all this talk about sex everywhere, sex, all this sort of manic push the accelerator on pleasure, does it not occur to us anymore that biology puts pleasure associated with purposes? Have we forgotten this? I mean, whatever you want to say about the complexities of human diversity, there's a sort of normative center to this whole thing, that sex is a among other things, a way of promoting a process that relates to species continuity. And I'm not clear that we're serving our society well, or even within our families well, when we don't remind our children or each other of this connection. The meaning of embodiment, it's so powerful. I mean, look at, just not to be vulgar in any way, but consider the breasts. I was sitting in an airplane once in Southwest where they actually have seats facing each other. And the guy across from me had all these tattoos in his arm, and he saw I was reading a book on genetic engineering, and he started inquiring what I did. And then I asked him what he did, and he said, well, I run a strip place in Arizona. And he said, oh, it's really amazing. These men come in and the women take their shirts off and they're dancing there with their breasts showing. And I said, yeah, isn't that interesting that they're so, you know, rivetingly interested in the reproductive organs of the woman, that the breasts are part of the process of procreation and nurture. And he said, wow, I never thought of that. See, we forget it all. We forget how it's connected. And for most of human history, it didn't matter because he couldn't do anything about it. Now, the technology that Professor Jones wisely speaks of is actually displacing it. The problem is that desires are directions. They are not destinations in themselves. They lead us to things that are actually beyond our necessarily immediate desires, but fulfill a deeper wisdom that nature carries in the program, and I think by God's design. And the other side of that is when we start to see sex as related to children, we suddenly reevaluate an awful lot of our ethical and social constructions. I used to give a lecture at Stanford on Valentine's Day called Love, Sex, and Genes. And I tried to convince the students that they can't live in one realm of life discordant from the implications in the other. I tell them about various dimensions of this, but one of them I very plainly said to them, maybe one ethical construction you should live with is that you shouldn't do anything you wouldn't have wanted your parents to have done, like being promiscuous and then giving you congenital syphilis, for example. And you shouldn't necessarily do something that you wouldn't want your children to do, because when you think about your children, you have high ethical ideals, and you're going to give up on those? And I also said to them that I thought perhaps they shouldn't be having whatever else they may think about sex, you know, at least a minimum ethic for sex. I don't think it's an adequate ethic. It's not the Christian ethic. But at a minimum, I think they should take seriously the notion that they shouldn't be having sexual intercourse in a context where they might get pregnant, unless they could welcome the child into the world. Because you don't want to indulge your pleasures and then end up killing a developing life because it was inconvenient to you. I think the large picture here is that sex relates in the most human beings to the procession of life into family, and that that means that sex has to be contained within a deep and profound spiritual social context, and the spiritual context is that image of Christ who died for his church and didn't feel as though it was just life was a silk ribbon of easy flow. Basically, sex, this whole complex zone, needs to be placed within the large context of self-giving and sacrificial love. It's not that happy, indulgent utopia that we've been hoping for.
I'll throw this out, and then you can all fight about it over supper time. I don't disagree with anything that was just said, but I want to add something. And that is, you know, the original question was, is this variability in sexuality part of God's plan for creation, or is it the result of sin? And I don't know the answer to that question, but one thing I'll tell you is that, you know, we're being very human-centric in this whole conversation. And boy, if you look across the natural world, there is buzzing, blooming diversity, and including in gender and sexuality, all over the place. And you've got species that, you know, that males and females have different reproductive roles. You've got species where individuals change their gender and their gender role. You've got species whose sexuality gets expressed in a whole diversity of ways. And boy, there's just a lot of diversity out there. And sex, yes, it's related to procreation. But it isn't just related to procreation. And sex is used throughout the natural world for all kinds of other purposes that are also really important, including community and relationship and so on. And so, yeah, it's related to procreation, but that's not its only function. And I'll just throw that out there and let you mull on that.
Are you sure you can draw conclusions like that from animal sexuality? I mean, I'm not actually comfortable with that statement. I think, you know, yeah, you have male sheep mounting male sheep, but I think maybe they're just triggered by basic symbols. There's a semiotics of sexuality. I wouldn't draw from that that they're necessarily homosexual in the way human beings would be homosexual.
Oh, I wasn't arguing that they're homosexual. All I'm saying is that you can't, you know, there's so much diversity out there in nature, you can't, you know, you can't draw normative claims from any particular species. But the question was, is the diversity of sexuality and gender that we've been talking about here among human beings, is it part of God's creation? And all I'm saying is that if you look throughout the creation across species, you see a lot of diversity. What that means, what we do with it, that's an important conversation, but it's there.
But we're a very different species. I mean, you know, the fact that bonobos rub genitals before so they don't fight over food, I don't think that necessarily has anything to do with human sexuality. I'm not comfortable with it myself. I don't think it's a justification for turning all of global civilization into California.
Well, I don't think I was arguing that, but you're perfectly free to be uncomfortable with it. I'm not so uncomfortable with the notion that we are creatures too. And that's part of who we are.
So you think we might make a good case for using sexuality as an sort of a casual expression of friendship, or as a means of social harmony?
I think that first of all, I'd want to have a conversation about defining our terms a little bit, because what are we talking about when we say sexuality? And I have a feeling that we're starting a conversation that is going to keep us here for a long time, and people want to go eat supper. So,
and I think that having a theologian present would be very, very helpful as well. I'm sure they would have something to say about whether or not these things that we see in nature are the result of the fall. Is probably an important voice in that conversation.
Okay, Don has a question.